Российская экономика кризис в целом миновала.
Мы никогда не говорили, что там нет людей, которые занимаются там решением определенных вопросов.
Кто-то в турецком руководстве решил лизнуть американцев в одно место. Не знаю, правильно ли поступили или нет.
He claimed the worst was over in Russia's economic crisis. He tacitly admitted the presence of Russian military personnel in eastern Ukraine. In one of his more colorful lines, he suggested that Turkey wants to lick the Americans in a certain unmentionable place. Vladimir Putin's marathon year-end press conference is an annual ritual that is never short of pithy one-liners. And in the midst of all the spin, theatrics, and bluster, it's also an event rich in messaging about the Kremlin's current thinking and its priorities for the year ahead. The latest installment of the Putin show lasted more than 3 hours. So where were the signals and where was the noise? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the year-end edition of the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
So thanks for coming on. Well, in terms of theatrics, Putin's obsession with the bodily fluids continues apace. In addition to the remark about Turkey's licking something on America, Putin also called the appointment of Mikhail Saakashvili as Odessa governor, quote, spitting in the face of the Ukrainian people. But in fact, Putin seemed less at ease than he usually does in events like this. His jokes seemed forced. He was constantly glancing at his watch, and he appeared particularly defensive when discussing the economy. What was your main takeaway, Mark? How did you read this event that sums up the year every year?
In some ways, I was actually perversely enthusiastic about it. It was much less exciting and fun than usual, which is why I understand that particularly the foreign correspondents were quite disappointed, because in a way, they go to this hoping to be able to write a nice colour piece rather than because they expect to have detailed information about the economy laid out before them. But precisely for me, this was much less of the usual empty exercise in Putin's personality cult. There was much less of the staged about it. He was much less comfortable, and so he should be, because after all, this is a country with considerable troubles at the moment. And to me, this is actually what it came across as. It was generally about the real issues. Yeah, of course, there were going to be the zingy one-liners, but frankly, if you're going to expect people to sit for over 3 hours, then you have to have something. The economy was absolutely front and center, again, as it should be, which says a lot. And it was, although clearly, again, like any politician, he was trying to play it up as much as possible, he was also recognizing the real problems. It was quite interesting, for example, he made the point that about the fact that the expectation had been that oil was going to be at $50 a barrel, but now it clearly wasn't going to be there, and that therefore they would actually need to adjust their calculations to that, which was a recognition of reality, which is worth dwelling on just for a moment, because how often does Putin recognize reality in inconvenient contexts? But secondly, it was actually recognition of a mistake that, okay, maybe it was done by the government, but nonetheless, he made a point of saying, you know, this is from all of us. There were real questions being asked, in some cases very pointed ones. You've raised on the Daily Vertical the one about
Yekaterina Vinokurova, yeah.
Exactly, about essentially corruption, and is this how you expected it to be? We also had, you know, the Nemtsov murder being raised and so forth. So real questions were being raised. He wasn't necessarily giving real answers, but again, you know, we have to realize, what politician in those circumstances actually gives real answers? You know, we always get kind of the prepackaged ones. So to round that up, I mean, for me, this was actually much more about real politics and real issues than usual. And I don't say that it's optimistic in the sense of, because I suddenly think Putin is changing and going to become a different figure. I just do feel that, as it were, the box around Putin is shifting, changing, becoming tighter, becoming more uncomfortable. And he's actually recognizing that. This is why he was looking so uncomfortable. And again, I think this for me is encouraging, because one of the leitmotifs of this year has been not really knowing how well he realizes the state of the country. So actually, the more uncomfortable he looks, the more encouraged I get, because it implies that he actually has some idea of just how bad things are.
Now, my takeaway is, I mean, I thought the goal of the day was to show that he was in control, that basically the situation's, there's an economic crisis, but everything's under control. I got it all under control. I'm not sure he entirely succeeded in that. I thought on the economy, he looked really defensive and sometimes in denial. When he said the worst of the crisis is behind us, and that was very early on in the event. And then he goes on about industrial and agricultural production being up, and airline passengers in Russia's airports are up. And he just, it sounded like a little bit in denial, a little bit defensive. On Yekaterina Vinokurova's question, I thought that was his worst moment of the day. He stammered through that thing. I don't know if you remember the point where he couldn't say Chaika's. He kept saying Chaika, 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 pointing to the paper. And then he just moved on to something else. He didn't want to talk about his scandal plagued prosecutor general. So I thought I didn't think his performance was so sharp. It was, and he clearly wanted to get it over with. He said right at the outset, almost at the very first thing he says, I pretty much think I laid everything out in my speech to Parliament. So I mean, you know, basically, let's just get this over with. And he didn't seem to want to be there. He didn't seem to be having fun like he usually seems to be doing at this.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing, depending on how you interpret that. Yeah.
I mean, look, of course he was going to put the most positive spin on it. But again, you know, we have to come back and think about it. You name one politician who actually would have. I mean, firstly, how many Western politicians have 3-hour press conferences? But even if you did, name one politician who, in similar circumstances, would turn up and say, "Yeah, things are going really badly. It's basically because of mistakes we made. We haven't really got a strategy about how to deal with it. We're just hoping that things can carry on and there will be a deus ex machina," whatever. No one would ever say that. And in some ways, and my goodness, here I am. I'm becoming Peskov's understudy. Here I am actually sort of acting as Putin's defender. But
let me see your watch.
Context. Well, there you go. You see, my wrist is blank. I'm waiting for my Rolex. It should be waiting for me in Moscow next week. But the point is actually that, again, you know, of course, it was an uncomfortable situation. And yes, he didn't answer things particularly well. He didn't really have an answer for the corruption question. When he was asked about Nemtsov and the suspect being in Chechnya, he gave the very sort of bland, "Well, you know, the relevant organs are investigating, and we should leave it to them," and so forth. But again, that's exactly what you would expect. The very fact that he's there, he's being faced with these uncomfortable questions. He doesn't have a nice answer, which actually also tells us that these questions were not pre-scripted and it was not part of the theater. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we'll give him a tricky question and then wham, he'll have a sort of really good answer for it and everyone will press. No, this actually was, you know, within the confines of these kind of exercises, a genuine press conference. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so he wasn't enjoying it. Good. Good for him. That's exactly what he. I mean, because this is a point of the leader being in a way taken to account, and some of the questions were real softballs, and as you'd expect.
You look so good. You look so fit. You're an example to all of our children. You know, I mean, there was a lot of that.
Exactly. There's going to be a lot of that, and so forth. But as I said, I mean, in context, in some ways, this was the first time we saw Putin the president, not Putin the czar or the secular saint, divorced from reality. This was Putin actually having to talk about the country to an extent, within politicians' bounds, the country as it really is. And yeah, so of course he's uncomfortable.
Sean, what was your takeaway?
I found it quite dull, and it made me wonder.
Do you have to sit through the whole 3 hours like I did?
No. I listened to about an hour, half of it, and then I skimmed the transcript of the rest of it. But you know, I was also thinking about who's the audience for this, because clearly it's not for your average, you know, Russian who's going to sit here and listen, especially if you consider like the first 15 minutes was kind of like a report to the Central Committee. It was just an inundation of macroeconomic figures. So it's very much for the audience is, I think, the press. And the press takes this information and distills it down and writes their articles about it. And it's clear that he wanted to talk about the economy. I mean, it made him uncomfortable, but this is what he wanted to talk about. He actually complained at one point. Somebody raised a question about Syria, and he's like, don't ask me about Syria. I wanted to ask me a question about the economy. I think the discussion of the economy is quite interesting, and I think it's worth putting into context. Yeah, the figures aren't great, and as Mark said, like most politicians, he tried to make the best of them that he could. But I think that, you know, when the government and Putin and his people look at the macro statistics and they compare them to 2009, for example, what they're experiencing now is nowhere near the bottom out that they experienced in 2009. Now, the difference being that the oil price is not going
to go back up to 100.
This is the main issue. But in terms of GDP growth, in terms of inflation, in terms of wages, in terms of all of this is sometimes a little bit bad, worse, sometimes a little bit better, but pretty comparable to 2009.
And there were no sanctions in place in 2009.
And there are no sanctions in place, so these two factors are, I think, are really important, the oil price and the sanctions, because it's preventing the government from doing what they did in 2009 is they're not engaging in a major stimulus.
Right. They can't.
The economy. They can't. They don't have the money. So it's a kind of mixed bag. So yeah, things aren't great. Sure. The numbers are kind of peaking up. Things have bought. And if you look at the figures, for the most part, things have bottomed out. If you look at the major macroeconomic indicators, things have at this point have bottomed out. But I'm sure if they're looking back at 2009, they're kind of like giving a collective or sighing and saying, phew, you know, things aren't as bad. But like that caveat being, well, the mechanisms that they had in 2009, being able to borrow, you know, at least financial institutions being able to borrow.
Right. They have no liquidity.
The oil price isn't there. And honestly, I don't know, you know, I don't know what the Russian bond market is, but I would imagine Russian bond. I don't know what the bond issue is, but the ability to borrow money. But, you know, if you look at it and the ratio of GDP is high, of debt to GDP is higher at 17%. But in general, you know, if you compare it to most countries, that's not a bad ratio to GDP to government debt.
Yeah, but so, I would take issue that this is bottomed out, because really not only are the oil prices down, the sanctions in place, they're losing their energy market in Europe. I mean, they're losing a big chunk of it. There's the sources of revenues are not going to be there.
And that's true, but according to the economic macroeconomic statistics, and I looked at them this morning, things have bottomed out. The GDP is it's hit the bottom and it's going up. That doesn't mean it's not going to go down again. It certainly could. But at this point in time, when Putin is going and giving his 3-hour press conference, he can say, okay, things are looking okay. They're not, they're bad, but they're not that bad. Things are turning the corner. And when they reflect on it in terms of 2009, they certainly should be a bit relieved. This is my only point. Now the main issue is that I think, say, if a Russian, average Russian out there, and Russian, you know, standard issues on the ground are regional. Life is different, you know, in some provincial town, and the cost of living is different, and the wages are different. It could be much harder than it is, say, in other parts. So when I would imagine an average Russian listening to these kind of macroeconomic statistics, it may give them some sense of okay in a general things, but when they look around their normal life, these statistics have nothing to do with their daily life.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I agree that he's kind of dealing with reality as such, but in terms of actual Russians' daily experience, I think this remains unaddressed for the most part.
Yeah, he had one of his more eyebrow raising lines was when he made this point that I come from a working class background. I understand the plight of the truckers. Now, he did come from a working class background, but he's very, 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 very much removed from that working class background now.
And I think the response and what was interesting for me is his response to the question about Chaika and his response to the question about the truckers. And they're really revealing. When it came to Chaika, he was uncomfortable. He didn't really want to answer. And then he just said, well, his answer was basically the father doesn't answer for the son.
Yeah.
And there are institutional legal mechanisms to deal with this, if there is such a thing. When he answered the question about the truckers, he went, you use the resources, you have to pay. All the money is going to road construction. And look, guys, we all know that you're working under the table.
Right.
And we know this is a gray economy. So you're taking in more than you're saying. So you need to pay taxes. So it was an interesting, like, on the one level where the corruption is really happening, he went to legal institutional mechanisms.
Right.
When it went for the truckers, it was, you guys are corrupt. You know you are.
Right.
And stop it.
No, that's a good point. And it's a typical example of how Putin kind of cherry picks the facts to suit the argument that he makes. That's a really good observation. Another one of the things I noticed that jumped, well, of course, the tacit admission that the Russian military is operating in Ukraine. He hedged it and qualified it, but he, at the end of the day, it was basically it went farther than the Kremlin had ever admitted that at least GRU is active. He said there's no regular troops in Ukraine, but there are people performing tasks, including military tasks. Read into that what you will. Mike, what was interesting there was, why do this now? Why do this now? I mean, Mark, do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, you're a military observer kind of guy. What did you read into that? Why make that admission?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that my alter ego Peskov has already sort of stepped that one back a little bit and said, well, essentially, he was talking about the volunteers, of course, not people who are there actually on state assignment. Well, you know, that's what a press flak is there to do. No, I mean, I think that, well, let's assume that it wasn't just some slip, because I don't think
it was.
Like this you'd make a slip. No, I mean, I suspect that this is the sort of the standard pattern, the no, well, maybe slightly, and then in due course, yes. But that's what you do. And anyway, this is just as true as when we're talking about Afghanistan under the Soviets, which went through this multi-year process from there are no Soviet troops there, there are Soviet troops there on exercises with Afghans who are sometimes attacked by bandits, all the way through to, oh yeah, there's a war. So anyway, I mean, I think this is just part of the process. Mm-hmm. You need to recognize, if you're running a propaganda state, as which, you know, this undoubtedly is, that you have to be careful to try and avoid too huge a gap between people's observable reality and what your propaganda line is. Now, look, you know, enough people have been cycling through the conflict in the Donbass, and although they're all volunteers, none of them are conscripts. But nonetheless, you know, after a certain point, you reach a critical mass where everybody knows someone who's actually been to the Donbass. And therefore, every time then on TV they say, not a single Russian there except three Cossacks named Ivan. You know, people realize that that's actually not the truth. And that becomes corrosive because, you know, as soon as you actually have an observable point where you say, well, I know I'm being lied on that point, it makes people much more likely to question the other point. So you have to have some fudge sort of point, which actually means you can kind of admit a little bit. So people, when people do know that they know one guy who's been to the Donbass, you can say, huh, it was one of those guys that Putin was talking about, rather than just those lying so-and-sos. So, I mean, I think it's part of this kind of careful calibration that, you know, is for the Kremlin, it's a very, very time-honored tactic. Mm. And also, I think it was thrown in here, because, yes, it was a pretty dull press conference. And in part, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, to go back to Sean's point about the sort of the beginning of the speech being just this recitation of macroeconomics. Yeah, the whole point of that is 99.whatever% of the audience do not care, do not remember, do not even actually catch all the data points that are being thrown out. The point is just to show that Putin is, a, you know, in command of the facts. It's meant to be just reassuring. Well, likewise, I mean, in the middle of this dull press conference, what better time to just slip in that first next sort of recognition? It's taking out the trash day. It's actually the point where you can start to put things onto the record in a way that as few people as possible will actually really pay attention to it. And if you look at the Russian papers, it's interesting. A lot of them have been picking up on the Chaika point.
Yes.
A lot of them, their sort of main headline is basically, you know, the government is not in the business investigating people's children. But this issue, I mean, it's really not been a factor.
No, it got a lot of play in the Ukrainian press, I can tell you that. And another part of that answer that got a lot of play in the Ukrainian press, because one of the questions was, remember, the question was from a Ukrainian journalist saying, you say there's no Russian soldiers in Ukraine. Well, I want to say hi from, and he named two soldiers that are in custody in Ukraine. And then the question was, would you be willing to trade these for Nadia Savchenko and Oleg Sentsov? And Putin's answer was very, very, very interesting. He said, we're willing to trade all prisoners for all prisoners. We want a comprehensive thing. But the Ukrainians are saying some of these are in for criminal activity. And so and if once they decide to be honest, it was a beautiful projection. Once they decide to be honest about all of this, you know, while they're holding Nadia Savchenko, who's clearly a prisoner of war, not a, you know, where they're charging her under criminal statutes. But he did say would be willing to have a broad exchange. And Poroshenko and I have talked about, he even used respectfully referred to him by his name and his patronymic, and said, you know, we've talked about this and we're pretty much on the same page. I thought that was really interesting. It made me think maybe there is going to be some movement on the Savchenko issues. Sean, did you pick up on that one?
Not so much. I mean, the admittance of you know, the Russian military operations in eastern Ukraine, I mean, at this point, you know, he has really nothing to lose to admit this in many respects. The heat of the conflict is pretty much wound down. International attention is not very focused on it. So, you know, yeah, he could give out this kind of taste of, yeah, sure, we had people there. But, you know, I think for the most part in discussing Ukraine, he's kept to the general script which is, you know, let's proceed with negotiations. There needs to be a solution. Stick with Minsk II. Blah, 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 blah. There was no, you know, he didn't inflame this situation at all. I mean, if you compare his comments about Ukraine to, say, Turkey.
Yeah, well, that was the other thing.
Which are a big contrast. And also, if you look at, you know, the three kind of hot spots in terms of Russian international relations, Ukraine, Turkey in particular, and the West in general, the United States, he was kind of downplaying, or at least sounded more conciliatory about Ukraine and the U.S.
Yes, he was.
And more kind of hot-headed about Turkey. So I think that's in general, this kind of press, when you look at this press conference, you kind of, at least I try to take it as a whole and look at, okay, he said this here, but then in another place he took a different tone, and compare his answers to kind of get at, you know, where he's thinking, and where he's signaling too, because like I said, I think this press conference in general is for the press. And for them to take things and distill it. And I think the point about what's being reported in various media is interesting, because I noticed that too, that the Russian press is picking up on the Chaika thing. I think the front on Kommersant's website right now, their front lead story is Peskov commenting on the Chaika issue.
Right.
I didn't look at what the Ukrainians are reporting on, but I mean, it's not surprising they're going to report on issues that you know, more pertain to Ukraine. And then the American press, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, even if you can include the Guardian, they're mostly focusing on these kind of, you know, Saakashvili, the quips.
The quip.
You know, the kind
and the, you know, Sepp Blatter should get the Nobel Prize. Donald Trump should be the American president. You know, I mean,
which the Donald Trump is actually kind of funny, because I think Putin was just trolling.
Yeah, no, he was clearly trolling. He was clearly trolling the United States on that. The Blatter thing looked heartfelt, though. If you look at the answer on Sepp Blatter, he's like, this man's done so much for football and so much in the humanity. He deserves the Nobel Prize. And if you look at his body language and his facial expressions, he meant that. He meant that. Yeah, the Trumpy was just trolling. Mark, you had something to add on the Savchenko and with the bit about the POWs.
Yeah, Just before I forget, another point on the Chaika coverage. What I think is really interesting about the coverage that we're seeing in the Russian press, and this includes things like Izvestia, which are obviously very much kind of close to the Kremlin. They're not running stories saying Chaika Jr. is upstanding and entirely innocent. They're running stories saying it's not the government's job to look at officials' kids. So the interesting thing is that they're not actually simply saying that the Chaikas are all sort of pure as driven snow, which is actually quite an interesting little nuance.
It's an odd position that it's not the government's job to look at officials' kids, even when officials' kids are breaking the law. It certainly is. They see it as the government's job to look into Navalny's brother, for example.
That's a different matter. I mean, they're talking about precisely the whole sort of business of that. The activities of the father. But this is it. But actually, they're keeping the story alive. They're not actually burying it, and they're not just simply whitewashing it. So there's something going on. But anyway, going back to the issue, and this also refers to your earlier point about signaling and audiences. Because, yes, the Russian public get the sort of the speech as a whole. Our president is on top of things. The press, the Russian press, pick up on the individual bits and pieces and make what they will of it. The other audience, of course, is the external,
the West
one. And I think for them, it's always not so much the speech as a whole, but clearly the bits that have been crafted for them. And therefore, I think it is interesting looking at how he approached the issues of Ukraine, Turkey, and Syria. In that with Ukraine and the business of the prisoner swap, he was not talking to Ukrainians. I don't think he cares, really, what Ukrainians think and what the Ukrainian press says. The business about prisoner swaps was to show Russians that essentially he will do everything possible to get Russians back. But it's also for the West, because prisoner exchange is a part of the Minsk process, and we're coming up to that. So again, I mean, I think he's trying to desperately get whatever brownie points he
and
can.
And the Ukrainians insist.
We're willing to do this.
Yeah, no, and the Ukrainians insist that Savchenko is part of that. And the Russians say no, because she was charged under a criminal statute because she, allegedly illegally crossed the border in that fantasy they concocted in her trial. But Putin turned around and accused Poroshenko of doing exactly what he's doing. He's saying, well, Poroshenko's just putting all our soldiers in, charging them on criminal charges. So it was just an interesting bit of gymnastics on his part, but it was also, I thought, an interesting signal that maybe we're going to see some movement on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the Russians do want some kind of movement. The point is, they are really, for internal psychological and political reasons, thoroughly constrained with what they can offer. But I mean, I think they're trying to find some formula to at least have some kind of progress. So Ukraine, really, he's signaling more than anything else to the West, more than to the Ukrainians. Turkey, again, yes, the usual sort of high-flown rhetoric we'd expect, but again, a big effort to try and sort of emphasize his point about, some of my best friends are Turks. The very fact that he actually turned to a Turkish journalist to ask a question to reply to. Again, I think trying to sort of, again, he's trying to, and this is, I think, one of the issues, one of the leitmotifs of this speech, tiptoeing between all the landmines that he himself has laid.
Right.
But that he's becoming aware that he's laid them.
Now, I thought his rhetoric on Turkey was pretty aggressive, though.
It was pretty aggressive, but look, I mean, I first of all, I suspect that there are people in the Kremlin who are saying, well, this is the only language that these Turks understand. It all comes down to sort of rather sort of crass caricaturing, but again, it's just rhetoric. I mean, I think we have to realize that words have a shelf life of a week or a day.
Right.
It allows him to sound tough, and even then, I mean, it's quite interesting that his when he gave his particular, and we won't go into the detail here, point about where Turks might want to put their tongues. Again, it wasn't he was saying the Americans told the Turks to do this. He was saying maybe the Turks thought that they could please the Americans.
He was kind of letting the Americans off the hook there, which I thought was
absolutely
kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny how, again, flipped to sideways, places like Sputnik have been very much pushing the, is it time for, are people thinking that Turkey should leave NATO? Well, the answer, of course, is no one is. However uncomfortable they may be with Turkey, no one is thinking that. But the very fact that Sputnik and other propaganda organizations are trying to push this shows that's one thing they're trying to do. They're trying to basically say, look, Turkey's bad, and actually it's dragging the rest of you down. We don't hold what the Turks do against you. It's very crude attempts at divide and rule. But nonetheless, that's clearly the thing. Final point I'd make, though, when we look at these little kind of segmented elements, is the Syria sort of conversation. And again, it was quite interesting because it was very much, the question was very much framed as, do you really still have a plan? It was actually quite a skeptical question. And he said, yeah, I have a plan, and it's for peace talks, and it's possible. It was a flabby, woolly question, but perfectly honest. If you ask President Obama, tell us your plan on ISIS,
right?
You're not going to get anything more specific or convincing. But again, the interesting thing was there. Actually, I mean, he didn't indulge in quite the same kind of rhetorical American bashing that he has in the past.
I saw very little America bashing.
No, exactly. He didn't make this immediately about Assad first and foremost.
He said Assad has to stay.
Well, yeah, but again, you know, but it was much more in the context of, you know, a peace structure, that, you know, a peace process and so forth.
He said he supports the American efforts to draw up a UN Security Council resolution, but that Assad should be party to that process.
But this is it. Party to the process does not necessarily say he has to still be there at the end of it. This is what the Russians really have been saying. They've been saying, as it were, that Assad, we cannot have Assad going as a precondition. But that doesn't mean that Assad staying forever also has to be a precondition. Right. And this is why, I mean, they are clearly saying, make it worth our while and we will pull Assad out.
Well, it's interesting how the Russian and the American rhetoric is starting to converge on this. If you notice John Kerry's comments after his trip to Moscow. On the Turkey thing, it reminds me of what Vladimir Frolov said about there's basically, we have threat substitution going on here, is the phrase he used to describe it. Turkey's kind of taken the place of the West as the big boogeyman. But in that context today, I don't know if you caught Naryshkin's comments about NATO today. Naryshkin made some comments about NATO today. He said NATO is a cancerous tumor on the body of Europe that needs to be eradicated. And then he goes on to say how it should be eradicated. He's like, well, first you get Turkey out. You know, again, along the lines of what you're saying, what outlets like Sputnik are saying, that should Turkey leave NATO? This is doing it from the other direction, right? So it was pretty interesting along those lines. So the either Naryshkin didn't get the memo, or which I doubt, they're keeping this line of anti-NATO rhetoric going.
Well, there always has to be the more extreme figure, and okay, in the past that tended to be Zhirinovsky, and then to a lesser, slightly lesser extent, Rogozin or whatever. One of Putin's sort of, again, yeah, I wouldn't exactly call it a strength; let's call it a tactic. Is precisely he needs to have people who are less visible but more extreme. So that he then sounds like a sort of a more moderate voice.
Right. And he used the Speaker of the State Duma to do that in this sense. All right. Well, that's a good way to segue into the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look back at the year that was and look ahead at the year that will be. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Официальный курс Центробанка
рубля напрямую зависит от нефти.
Четверка ищет в Минске компромисс.
В Москве убит известный политик.
Немцов скончался на месте.
Президента уничтожит почти 7 тонн сыра.
Чем Роза и Герберы навредили России.
Россия нанесла авиаудары по позициям боевиков ИГИЛ.
Российскую авиагруппировку в Сирии и небо на сотни километров.
The year ended much as it began, with oil prices tanking and the ruble hitting historic lows. And in between, we had a continued stalemate in Ukraine, the assassination of a leading opposition figure, a war on foreign food, and a new Russian military adventure in Syria. So let's play a little game. Looking back at 2015, what were the key events, the ones that will have lasting significance, and why? I get to go last.
Well, I mean, look, let me just start with the two most obvious ones. Let me sort of pluck the low-hanging fruit. Obviously, it would be the assassination of Nemtsov and the deployment of Russian forces into Syria. So February and September. But I think to try and give some kind of coherence to that, I mean, for me, generally speaking, 2015 was definitely the year of chickens and buzzards coming home to roost. And I wouldn't say necessarily the growing realization or the full realization, but the Kremlin's at least partial realization of this. And if we look at it this way, I mean, Nemtsov represents, frankly, for me, a weakness and limitation of the Kremlin. Now, that is presupposed on, I definitely buy the idea that either Kadyrov actually instructed the assassination, or at the very least was then happy promptly, retrospectively, to sanction it, and has continued to do so. And the point is, there is nothing that the central law enforcement and security apparatus mm-hmm. can do about it. Putin is not willing to withdraw his krisha, his roof, his protection from Kadyrov. There is this sense, frankly, I think wrongly, but nonetheless, a genuine sense that if anyone tries to move against Kadyrov, next thing you've got 20,000 ravening Chechens beating down the gates into Moscow. And so it actually says that even in this most sort of centralized, semi-authoritarian regime, that in fact, because of the decisions that they made to try and win the war in Chechnya, sort of, I wouldn't say on the cheap, but at least to try and win it by Chechenizing it, they have in effect created this monster and this autonomous little princedom within Russia that can reach out and kill people almost literally in the shadow of the Kremlin and get away with impunity. So that was the Nemtsov thing. But likewise, on the other hand, Syria, I think, actually showed what Putin can do. If Nemtsov showed what Putin can't do or can't bring himself to do, Syria showed what Putin can do. It was and still is, a very minimalist foreign adventure, but nonetheless one that has reshaped Western policy, or certainly American policy. It has reshaped Russia's position in the world. It has rolled back much of the isolation that clearly was such an objective after Crimea. It carries with it considerable risks, but so far it's actually proven quite successful and quite controllable, and it represents a sort of a good play of a very weak hand. So here's the irony. Actually, I think the Kremlin could get rid of Kadyrov if it wanted to do so. I think, and this is exactly the kind of thing in which it's strong in resources, but weak in will. Whereas in Syria, it took, I mean, it is frankly pretty weak in terms of geopolitical and military intervention capabilities, despite the reforms of the military. But nonetheless, it took its weak hand and with strong will played it well. Mm. So, I mean, I think these are the sort of the you know, the two interesting divergences, that in some ways the Kremlin is actually able to do things effectively, in some ways it's not. But to sort of give it that overall consensus, I mean, the reason Nemtsov could happen was precisely because of bad decisions made in Chechnya. The reasons why Syria had to happen was because of bad decisions made in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're actually seeing a whole series of bad decisions, including bad investment decisions in the early Putin terms when he had a chance to try and diversify the economy away from being dependent on hydrocarbons. All of these bad decisions seem to come to a head. Mm-hmm.
Sean, what do you think? What are your key events of the year?
I think the key event for me is certainly Ukraine. And granted, certain bad decisions were made, but I think that the Kremlin is satisfied with the results, and satisfied in the sense that they pretty much have put Ukraine in a deadlock in terms of its movement. It's done enough to kind of freeze the situation, force the issue in terms of the Ukrainians basically having to do something with the East. They've put the West is increasing its pressure, you know, behind the scenes on Ukraine in terms of doing what it needs to do in following the Minsk agreements. So I think that situation is actually quite satisfying to them. I mean, yeah, it wasn't their hopes and dreams, but given the conflict being kind of wound down, the military side is mostly quiet, And now there's great pressures, and Ukraine is doing whatever the internal politics of Ukraine are such that, you know, particularly over the last couple of weeks, they're doing everything they can to shoot themselves in the foot anyways. So I think Putin can be satisfied with the results there. Now the cost and the costs are certainly long-term costs, but and those long-term costs are certainly coming to roost right now. But like I said a little bit ago, when they look back on other crisis points, you know, this is somewhat livable. And I think that the Syria situation is also important because it does show that Russia can be engaged in the world. From its point of view, it can play a positive role And given its lack of resources in terms of compared to, say, the United States, it can throw a wrench into things and push things in its direction, because I think there, like you said a few minutes ago, there seems to be a convergence on rhetoric. The gap between the U.S. position on Syria and Assad and the Russian position on Syria and Assad are gradually getting closer. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that they certainly could live with as well.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't consider the Nemtsov assassination as one of your key events?
You know, the Nemtsov assassination is actually interesting. I mean, I completely agree with Mark in terms of its larger kind of symbolic meaning in the internal structures of Russia and the place of Chechnya and Kadyrov in particular. But in terms of the assassination itself, it hasn't panned out. I mean, in due respect to Nemtsov, it hasn't panned out that much in Russia. It seems that it's been mostly forgotten in terms of a great event. Mm-hmm. If anything, it certainly sent an increased chill amongst, say, kind of oppositional
forces. This is precisely why I think it's one of the top.
But that chill is on top of three other chills.
Right. But this is a big chill.
This certainly is a big chill in those circles, but at the same time, there wasn't a lot of energy in the first place to chill,
right?
Because the rhetoric around Ukraine really kind of, you know, put things in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And I think too, the Russian opposition or oppositional forces in Russia, they don't really have much in terms of foreign policy. Right. The Russians have taken on mostly, you know, the government has been mostly engaged in foreign policy issues over the last year and a half or 2 years, one could say. And the Russian opposition, this is their weak point and ignoring the domestic situation, which is they have stronger points, not really strong, but in some cases stronger points. Since this has been virtually ignored in the kind of general discourse of high Russian politics, they haven't found, I don't think they've really found a place. Mm.
Yeah, no, they don't have a lot of answers on foreign affairs. This is true. I would say Nemtsov certainly, but I'll put a slightly different spin on it than Mark had. This was actually unprecedented that somebody of Nemtsov's rank, a former first deputy prime minister, was assassinated. The rules of the game, or at least the unwritten rules of the game that people seem to understand, was that if you were of that rank, even if you were in the opposition, you could be harassed, you could be arrested, but you couldn't be killed. And an important line was crossed there. I think it's an important line that was lost on nobody. I think that sent a chill not just through the opposition. I think it sent a chill through people in the governing elite. In terms of Kadyrov, I mean, on one, we're left with two bad options here, because the thing I assume that this was Kadyrov's operation. My only question, and it's been my question from the very, very, very beginning, did Kadyrov go rogue and Putin just decided he couldn't handle him? Or is Kadyrov a very convenient death squad with plausible deniability, if you follow me? I mean, Kadyrov pulls off one of these. You can always just say, oh, Kadyrov's crazy. But in reality, maybe. And I don't know. I don't know which of these it is.
But again, it comes back to why on earth would Putin care? I mean, Nemtsov was no threat to him. The kind of people whom
it wasn't about Nemtsov killed. It wasn't about Nemtsov. It was about the chill that it's going to send.
But, Again, but this was a point when he wasn't having to worry about the opposition in any way.
Not,
it was
not just the opposition.
Far more destabilizing, as you said, to have someone breaking the rules of the game, which means either the Kremlin is breaking the rules of the game or someone else can break the rules of the game
and get away with it.
See, neither of those, I think, are at all comfortable for Putin and for the Kremlin. Neither of those actually make Putin more sort of stably in place, because quite the opposite. In that kind of situation, you need to have a social contract that says, as long as you operate within these confines, you're safe, which gives you a reason to do so. If people think, well, you know, God knows what can happen, the old promises, the old understandings, the poniatia, you know, none of that really applies anymore, then in a way, no one knows what to do and how to be safe. I think this is what it comes down to. I mean, if you really want Nemtsov dead, I mean, even do you actually do it right by the Kremlin? I mean, there are so many other ways of doing it. And what one thing we do know is that it's a sort of a terrible accolade to have, but the Kremlin understands the theater of murder. You look at Litvinenko. You know, they do understand what different kind of symbol, that there is a difference between polonium and just pushing someone under an underground train. And therefore, I you know, who knows? Maybe I'll be found to be wrong at some point.
No, and I'm not sure what I think it could be.
See that.
But we both can agree this was certainly the most important domestic event of the year. On the foreign policy front, I mean, Syria, yes, but I actually think Russia's conflict with Turkey right now is actually quite important. I mean, it shows that Putin is not just in conflict with the West, but with elements of the non-West as well, number one. And number two, Mark, you point out the benefits of the way he's played the Syria situation, and he has gotten many, many, many gains out of this. Turkey illustrates one of the costs, and it might turn out to be a very big, very, very big cost. Saudi Arabia is also another major power Russia's going against in Syria, and there's going to be costs associated with that as well. On Ukraine, I would agree with you, Sean, and I had Ukraine on my list as well. I had kind of the Minsk agreement on my list, actually, not Ukraine specifically, but I got a little bit of a different. I think the jury is still out as to whether Putin's going to get what he wants in Ukraine. I think you're right. The Ukrainians are doing the best to shoot themselves in the foot right now. But really, there is an opportunity right now. And as far as Minsk, I thought Poroshenko played a very bad hand very well, in terms of not reintegrating the separatist held territories back into Ukraine on Moscow's terms. And Putin's clearly frustrated with this. This came out in his comments on the Minsk agreements yesterday in the press conference. So I still do think there's a window of opportunity for Ukraine to be able to walk away from this and saying, we just want a war with Russia. We just want a war with Russia. It depends how the peace plays out.
Walk away in what sense? To basically leave the Donbass to Russia? I mean, this is the main sticking point.
It's something that I've always said. I mean, basically, a frozen conflict is a tie. And in this case, I think a tie goes to Ukraine. I think that the rest of Ukraine can go on with reforming if they can box that conflict out. And if the rest of the country can get its act together and get on with reforming and become a successful Western economy, then Ukraine will be able to say, we beat Russia in a war. Right?
Yeah, but the only thing I'd have to say about that is that, you know, Ukraine's economy is in the East. I mean, it's destroyed right now for sure, but their industrial base
I would disagree with that. I mean, their retrograde, inefficient Soviet-era industrial base is indeed in the East. But when I talk about them reforming the economy, I mean like really getting these things like a high-tech center in Kharkiv and in Lviv, like they're talking about. There's a lot going on in the economy that's not in the East. So I think, and Alexander Motyl makes this point all the time, he would prefer they get rid of that sector of the economy that's in the East altogether. I wouldn't go quite that far. But remember, the occupied territories are only a tiny part of Donbass. It's not all of Donbass that Russia has. And I think, and I have said this before, and I'll say it again, although no Ukrainian official will ever say it publicly or out loud, I think they'd be happy just to walk away from this, to be honest. if the benefit of that would be to be able to reform the rest of the economy and get it in good shape. I think the jury is out on how this is going to play out. I think Putin seems to be getting more what he wants now, or he thinks he's getting more of what he wants now, but I'm not sure he's getting it. And I really do think that Poroshenko played a bad hand incredibly well on the sequencing and the implementation of Minsk. And I think Putin didn't get what he wanted here. They're not going to be able to jam these republics back in as Trojan horses the way they had hoped to. They're not going to let that happen. I am skeptical about the degree of pressure the West is putting on Ukraine right now. I'm not sure that that's actually what's going on. But we'll see. It was an important story in 2014. It's an important story in 2015, and I expect that it will continue to be an important into 2016. I think the way this turns out is going to go a long way to determining how the post-Soviet space finally does shake out in the post-Cold War. Mark, you want
to? Let me sort of triangulate to sort of take a, because it'd be a shame to have three people and not have at least three opinions. given that this is Ukraine. I mean, I think I'm probably closer to you, Brian, in the sense of, Sean, you're talking about the fact that essentially Ukraine has been put into a lock. I really don't see that. I don't see what, as it were, at the moment, external traction Russia really can bring to bear. Russia is still Ukraine's main trading partner. Russia ultimately can't do anything about that because actually it needs to be linked into the Ukrainian economy. Ukraine can't do anything about that because they need to be linked into the Russian economy. So you have this funny situation of both legal and illegal commerce continuing on a considerable level, even while in effect the two countries are at war. But in terms of, yes, I mean, obviously while there is this conflict taking place, you are denied a small chunk of rubble and decaying industries. I don't regard that as a great cost to Kiev, it has to be said. They have to, on the other hand, maintain certain military structures, which is diverting both political as well as economic resources that they could put to better use, one would hope. But beyond that, I mean, actually, Kiev has considerable freedom of maneuver in so many ways, I would suggest. And much of that they are indeed wasting. In terms of internal spats, failures to reform and such like. I mean, you sort of, Brian, you threw in that, you know, if Ukraine can get its act together, well, that's a pretty big if.
Well, no, it's a big if, and I made this point when I was in Odessa speaking to a group of Ukrainian students, and I said, really, you know, you ask what the West can do, but really, right now, this is really in your hands in a lot of ways, and it's really, Ukraine's future is, in a lot of ways, in its hands. It's not in Russia's hands as much as we thought, and it's not in the West's hands. It's in Ukrainians' hands.
It's not, but on the other hand, I mean, within, you know, there's not going to be some grand Marshall Plan or something like that. Unrealistic and such like. But on the other hand, within the constraints of the situation, well, actually the West, politically, it might be putting a bit of pressure on Kiev to say, look, you know, it'd be nice to get this settled. But the most important thing is the economy. And actually the West is being pretty supportive on economic grounds. And that's, as I said, that's really where it matters and where actually if the West didn't want to support Kiev, that's where things would be disastrous. So, yeah, I mean, I feel that we're in this situation where what we have at the moment is bearable for Kiev. I think it is more uncomfortable for Moscow.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, that's my feeling.
And this is why I feel Moscow would. It's not so terrible that Moscow is kind of wants to pull out at any cost. So this is why I think we're seeing this kind of covert process of haggling taking place.
Yeah.
In which actually Moscow is trying to see what would be the costs.
Yeah, and they're actually on Plan C. Actually, I mean, really, I mean, they didn't get Plan A, they didn't get Plan B, and they may or may not get Plan C.
Because my view of the Western commitment to Ukraine, and particularly the United States committed to Ukraine, to be somewhat lukewarm, and I think that it's good election in the United States is going to decide how that relationship is going to continue. But I've always felt the Obama administration's engagement with Ukraine has been far less than what some of the rhetoric is. I think they're kind of tiptoeing around this. They have to give it support because they have to, but they're not really going in full blown. I think there's a lot of skepticism, and I think Biden's recent visit, according to some of the backroom reports from Ukraine, was him saying, look, we didn't give you all this money so you can piss it away.
Yeah, no, Biden was there to give some tough love.
I mean, they're not going to abandon Ukraine because politically, geopolitically, it's not in the cards. But I think that the level of engagement of the Obama administration has been far, far less, and they're far more disinterested in material terms than is perceived certainly by Moscow. Now, I should say that I think that amongst certain elements of the American political elite, you know, people like John McCain and some people in the State Department, Ukraine is a particularly kind of project for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that extends fully into the Oval Office at this point. Mm.
All right, we're bumping up against the end here, so it's time to sum it up. What do we expect to see next year? If 2014 was the year of the resurgent Russia, 2015 was the year of the chickens coming home to roost, as Mark put it, what will 2016 be?
Well, if you want my prediction, it's going to be a sort of a very generic one. It's, you know, having, given that, as you know, I've got this notion of the three Russias, the sort of the normal Russia, the kleptocratic, and the ideological. I think this is going to be the year in which we, on the one hand, see the gaps between the three Russias widening, but also the inability of any of the three to actually connect with the others. I think this is going to be the real stress line. Putin understands the pain of the kleptocrats. He feels their pain, but when it comes down to it, he has an imperial project. And I think that matters. And he'll tweak and he'll try and sort of see what monies he can push towards the Rotenbergs and towards his son-in-law and everything else. But when it comes down to it, though, he is, I think, firmly viewing his place in history. And just simply being a good friend to corrupt oligarchs is not the kind of chapter heading he wants. Likewise, the kleptocrats can't and won't either abandon their kleptocratic principles to join Putin in his quest for whatever we want to call it, but nor are they going to stop being kleptocrats, and ordinary Russians aren't going to just simply say, fair enough, we will throw our backs behind Russian greatness or whatever. I think we're already seeing fatigue. Set in imperial fatigue, or not even that, sub-imperial fatigue, whatever you call it. And so I think that there's going to be mutual incomprehension verging on the outright hostility between these three Russias, and that's only going to get worse. And the Duma elections, purely theatre, they're important theatre, and they're the point where actually people can start to articulate, even if it's just around the kitchen table, what really matters to them.
Right. So it's going to be a big year. Sean?
Yeah. The Duma elections, I think, are key because it is theater. And usually and when these elections come, a lot of administrative resources are poured into them. And it will be interesting. And a lot of discussion and politics kind of domestic. I think domestic politics are going to be the main focus, of course, because they are Duma elections. And so it will be interesting to see how this plays out because, you know, by late summer, things are kind of going to start heating up into the fall in terms of Russian domestic politics. And it will be interesting to see how the government deals with that.
All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today, and that's all we have time for this year. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Yes, Novim Gadom, and talk to you next year from Moscow.
Yes. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, senior producer for RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, who you can and should follow on the Twitter at Pasha Buturin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Well, the next two Fridays are holidays, so we'll see you in 2016. And a happy holiday season to all. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.